out. He acted as if God was right about everything, which of course he is. And so when we talk about our faith, we have to realize that it is something beyond this idea that, well, it is just a prosthetic that we put on and we take off when we want. Our faith in God is as much about how great your ocean, how small my boat, about how great God is. And Isaiah chapter 40 declares the revealed glory of God. Isaiah lived in the final days of the southern kingdom. He began his ministry about 740 BC, and his challenge was he was prophesying during a very, preaching during a very turbulent time in the history of Israel about God's people. Because the echoes of the Babylonians were coming, and there was obviously things were going to be changing. Evil had swept the land. And God had already promised that I am going to destroy the city of Jerusalem. They had already seen the northern tribes completely destroyed, taken off into the Assyrian captivity, but they do not exist in any form. The Assyrians intermingled with the Jews, which is where the Samaritans came from. But those 10 tribes, gone. And now Judah stands on the precipice also to be like the northern tribes, to be completely annihilated. And now this message of the destruction of Jerusalem seemed incomprehensible. They could not imagine that God would allow the holy city, the temple of Solomon, to be destroyed. And yet that was the message that Isaiah was giving. But also the message that is given is the message that there is hope in a restored kingdom. Isaiah is kind of a fun book. And the reason it's a fun book is because it's got 66 chapters. And the message of the book of Isaiah is basically chapters 1 through 39. That's kind of the bad part. You know, you have somebody say good news and bad news. And you say, give me the bad news first. So Isaiah comes to them and he says, I've got good news and bad news. And so he tells them basically the bad news first, because the first 39 chapters of the book tell about the coming destruction of Jerusalem, the holy city, and that's very disturbing news. And then beginning in chapter 40, for the next 27 chapters, he tells them about the hope of the promises of God. Now here's a little side thing for you that is just free, and I think this is kind of cool. The Bible was not divided up into chapters until 1228. A guy named Stephen Langton decided that the Bible needed to be divided into chapters. It would not be divided into verses until actually much later. But what's interesting about, to me, I don't know, this is like God's hand in all of this, is that he divided up the book of Isaiah into these 66 chapters, and each one of those chapters are kind of individually showing the very message of the Bible itself. Because there are 66 chapters in the book of Isaiah, there are 66 books in the Bible. The Old Testament is made up of the 30, you're going to get a test on this afterwards, so you better pay attention. The first 39 books of the Bible are the Old Testament. The last 27 is the New Testament. And what we find mirrored in the book of Isaiah is, yes, you read the first 39 books of the Old Testament, and it's not just all bad news, but it is the majesty and the wrath of God and his justice. And really, we could say the last 27 is the hope that we find in Jesus Christ. And so what we find is that in the first 39 chapters of Isaiah, in that section of the book, it is talking about God's wrath. But then beginning in chapter 40, we find the salvation through God's servant. What passage do we often read in the Lord's Supper? Isaiah 53. Okay, think about what section that's in. That's not in the first part, that's in the second part. And Isaiah 53 fits into the New Testament of the book of Isaiah. We could say that Isaiah 40 is the book of Matthew in the book of Isaiah. That's getting confusing. I should leave that alone probably. But the fact of the matter is that Isaiah is trying to show the people, now that I have told you for this last series how God is going to bring destruction, he begins in chapter 40 and he declares the glory of God, the promises of God, the glorification of the servant who is going to become the crucified Christ on the cross. And this is a message of hope. And so when we come to Isaiah chapter 40, it is of no incidence that we begin this message with these words, "Comfort, yes, comfort my people, says your God. Speak comfort to Jerusalem and cry out to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill brought low. The crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough places smooth. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken." The voice said, "Cry out." And he said, "What shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades, because the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. O Zion, you who bring good tidings, get up into the high mountain. O Jerusalem, you who bring good tidings, lift up your voice with strength. Lift it up, be not afraid. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God." Verse 10, "Behold, the Lord God shall come with a strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom and gently lead those who are with young." I find what's interesting about that is that if you are familiar at all with the book of Matthew, that sounds just like Matthew. And of course, this is all New Testament doctrine that is here. And so what we find in Isaiah chapter 40 is that he is pointing to John the Baptist, who is introduced in the Gospels. In verses 3 through 4, he talks about the one who says, and the voice of the one who is crying in the wilderness. We know that that is John the Baptist. That is the one that is pointing to him. And the fact that in verses 6 through 8, it shows that the inability of man to save himself. He says in verse 8, 6, "Cry out, what shall I cry?" And he says that man cannot do anything to save himself. And then the latter part, verses 9 through 11, is that not speaking of Jesus, the chief shepherd, when he says that "I am the good shepherd," John 10, verse 11. And so we find that what Isaiah is crying out here as he is saying to the people is that, yes, there's the wrath of God coming, but look at the glory of God that's coming. Now, this will not be realized until the New Testament time when John the Baptist came onto the scene and the inability of man to be able to save himself and the fact that everything is pointing to Jesus, the chief shepherd, the Messiah, the one who is coming. And that's how Isaiah introduces this theme of the glory of God. He goes on in verse 12, and he says that who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, measured heaven with a span, and calculated the dust of the earth in a measure, weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or his counselor has taught him? With whom did he take counsel, and who instructed him, and who taught him in the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop in a bucket and are counted as a small dust on the scales. Look, he lifts up the isles as a very little thing. Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor its beast sufficient for the burnt offering. All nations before him are like nothing, and they're counted by him less than nothing and worthless. To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare to him? Verse 19, the workman molds an image, the goldsmith overspreads it with gold, and the silversmith casts silver in chains. Whoever is too impoverished for such a contribution chooses a tree that will not rot. He seeks for himself a skillful workman to prepare a carved image that will not totter. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He brings the princesses to nothing, and he makes the judges of the earth useless. Scarcely shall they be planted, scarcely shall they be sown, scarcely shall their stock take root in the earth, when he will also blow on them, and they will wither, and the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. To whom then will you liken me, or to whom shall I be equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high. See who has created these things. Who brings out their host by number. He calls them all by name, by the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one is missing. So he's introduced the prophetic coming of God's will to all mankind. And then he steps back and he says, I want you to take a moment and look at God. Look at how incredibly big God is. Because he tells them in verse 12, who has done that? The imagery of the heavens as being 2,000 million light years in diameter is awesome. I mean, when you look at, remember, I forgot which one of the, it wasn't Tom Hanks, but it was one of the astronauts that, was it Neil Armstrong? That when he got up into space and they were there in the capsule and he took his thumb and he just covered the earth. You know, there it is. I can't see earth and it's right behind my thumb. Some years ago, they back in the 60s, I think, they sent a satellite out into outer space and Voyager, and it just kept going and going and going. And some years ago, it was almost outside the furthest universe they knew it. And they sent it a code, and they said, we want it to turn around, and we want it to take a picture of space. And so it did. And so they got the picture back, and for those of us who are old enough to remember, when we took pictures, we took them to Walmart and we let them process them. And of course, whenever you got the pictures, you went through them. And there was always those that were nothing but blurry pictures, or you had your thumbprint on or whatever. And so we would throw the blurry pictures away. Well, this picture that came back looked like one of those Walmart rejects. Nothing but a bunch of, you know. But then they noticed that there was this white line that was going through the picture. And right in the midst of that little tiny white line was a small blue dot. The picture is called the blue dot. And what they realized is that in that infinite distance of space, as Voyager looked back towards basically where the Earth was, it caught a picture of Earth in that sliver of light as a small blue dot. Now, you and I live on a big planet to us because we travel. My daughter lives in Oklahoma, and we're never going to Oklahoma again. It's too far. That is like on the other side of the new United States. But when you look at things from God's view, and it's not even that big, the world that we live in, the expanse of the earth itself, is nothing but a little tiny blue dot in a sliver of light in the universe. And notice what he says here in verse 12. How great and how big is our God? He can take the waters of the earth and hold them in his hand. Now, according to other people, not me, the oceans of the world contain more than 340 quintillion gallons of water. That's a lot of water. If you want to impress your friends, buddy, here it is. 340 quintillion gallons of water, and yet he's got it right there. Now, if it's in his hollow of his hand, he's got a massive thumb. And the rest of his arm is just, I mean, that's every drop of water that is in there. The known universe stretches more than 30 billion light years. 30 billion light years. And yet, what does it say in verse 12 about what God does? He has measured the heaven with a span. With just a span. to him the whole universe. And see, here's the thing, folks, we haven't even found the rest of the universe. Every time we put a satellite out there with a telescope and we zoom beyond, you know what God is saying? He said, okay, you got this far. You ought to see what's next. And so we put another telescope. We put the Hubble up there. And he says, okay, you got this. You know what's coming? What's next? We don't even know how big this universe is. And yet he is able to hold the universe in the width of his hand. And then he says that he's calculated the dust of the earth in a measure. God knows how much dust is in the world. That bothered a little boy once. He was really concerned. He said, man, you know, we're made of dust. He asked his mom, and she said, yes, we're just made of dust. She said, why do you ask? He said, I don't know, but there's people either coming or going underneath my bed. There's a lot of dust. But God knows how much dust there is in the world. He has created the earth and its physical features in the perfect proportion necessary to maintain the intricate balance of life. When I was growing up in Florida, I heard stories about how that one day Florida is going to sink into the ocean and we're all going to die. And to some people, they were being very serious. Oh, yeah, you know, all this stuff is going to happen and Florida's just going to, you know, go away and we're going to, and I'm thinking, do what? You know, if you go to the beach and you watch the water, it does that all day long. It'll ebb out, it'll come in. But, you know, we look at how God has maintained the balance. The sun rises and, you know, in Florida, we get up in the morning and turn our heater on and by 12 o'clock we got the AC at 61. It's just the flux, and the moon rises, and it does all those things. And what's interesting about the whole idea of this verse in verse 12 is that it says that the waters of Earth's surface, the landmass, and the atmosphere were created with the precision necessary to cause proper gravitational and hydrological functions to sustain life on the planet. And you know I didn't write that. Somebody else did. What they are saying is, if you think about it, when you look around the world, it's basically in balance, and it's been that way. And it didn't take much to impress me, but one of the things that always sort of fascinates me, particularly at nighttime, is that I look out at the moon, and I love looking at the moon. It's not a good idea to look at the sun, but I love to look at the moon. And what just absolutely fascinates me, just absolutely blows my mind, is I'm out there, and I'm looking at the moon, and I'm thinking, Adam stared at the same thing. Now, is that cool or what? I did that twice today. Is that not just the most amazing thing? That you're looking at something that Abraham looked at. That David looked at. Everybody's been looking at that thing. But what's really interesting about the statement about the dust is that the Hebrew word shalish is translated measure, as he says in this idea, verse 12, weighed the mountains and the scales and hills in the balance, that this is translated measure, which means the dust of the earth, and it means a third. That's the meaning of that word. And so what Isaiah is saying is that the surface of the earth consists of land and water. Land, the solid part, covers about 57,584,000 miles, square miles, and it represents, you might want to sit down for this one, the landmass represents a third of the face of this earth. Which means Isaiah knew that the dust of the earth covered one third of the world 2,700 years ago. Because he was writing about the glory of God. And he recognized that the glory of God has made all of that possible. I mean, that's how great our God is. He holds the ocean in his hand. He measures the universe with the span. He knows the size of the dust He knows how much dust is in the earth. He knows how much land is there. That's how great he is. And then in verse 13 and 14, who's directed the Spirit of the Lord? The omniscience of God. I mean, how do you measure? How do you put him into a box and say who he is? With whom did he take counsel and instruct him? Who taught God? What he's basically saying is, who taught God what to do? Who told God? Nobody did. The world was created because God spoke and it came into existence. And the fact that God is so incredibly great, his revealed glory is that he is so much greater than his creation. I mean, the problem that man has with God is that they think that they are bigger and smarter than God. Are you kidding me? We are nothing compared to God. In verse 15, 16, and 17, you know what does not impress God? Nations. God is not impressed with nations of any kind. I mean, nations pride themselves on their power. They think that they are so mighty and their leaders are so, you know, can do anything they want. Ask the nation of Assyria how that worked out. Tell me where the nation of Babylon is today. Where are the Persians? Where are the Greeks? Where are the Romans? When the USSR existed, we were all scared to death of the bear going to come. What happened to them? We're concerned today. This is not a side note, but we're concerned about, oh, great nations. We're concerned about China. We're concerned about Russia. I mean, okay, there's concerns geopolitically and all like that. I'm not concerned about the nations of this world because I serve a God who is not impressed with the nations of the world. The Germans thought that they would create a 1,000-year Third Reich. The Japanese thought that they would do what they would do. Nations rise up. And I hate to tell you this, but the United States of America does not have to exist, and it may not one day. There are nations that we have seen in history that have been great nations, but they no longer exist. And the United States of America is the greatest nation on the earth, and I'm thankful to God that I'm here, but that doesn't guarantee that we're just going to be here. Because what Isaiah is telling God's people is this. Israel was sort of upset at God because they were saying, well, now God, you can't exist without us. And God is saying, you want to watch? You think I'm dependent upon you? I mean, the people of Israel thought God could not do without them. God is not dependent upon our goodness, our offerings, our wisdom, and our prosperity. It is we who need him. We're not as big as we think we are. We're not even close. We're not even at an atomic level of being in the relationship of God, because here's the thing that we have to understand. God can exist without us, because he did. We didn't come along until Genesis 1:1. And he existed before then. And that's all that Isaiah is saying, is when you talk about how great God is. Now, you go down to verse 21, and, you know, the folly of idolatry, verses 18, 19, 20, 23. And you know, the folly of idolatry is how silly that is, because they make these idols, you know, and if you're poor, you just go find a tree. Hopefully it's not rotten. If you read chapters 41 and 42, 43, 44, he talks a lot about the folly of idolatry. But the question he asks is, how can an idol compare with God? I mean, you put an idol up there. What is that going to compare to God? And it's not. And that's the foolishness of idolatry. And so he says there, the silversmith does what he does. And he does all those kinds of things. You know, big deal. But have you not known? Have you not understand? And of course, verse 22, we could talk about the fact that Isaiah told us that the earth was round back then, but he who sits above the circle of the earth, the people down here, we're nothing but grasshoppers. I mean, he is so much powerful than we are. And that's the folly of idolatry. Now, we may say, well, I don't worship idols. I wouldn't be too sure about that. I know some idol worshipers today. I do. I know some idol worshipers that are also members of the body of Christ. Sure do. Oh, they don't go home and fall down to some little funny-looking guy. An idol is anything that distracts us from God. An idol is anything that comes before me and God. An idol is something that I trust in more than I do God. There are people that believe that their job is more important than God. That's become their idol. Because they can't exist if they don't do whatever their job says, and yet they would deny God and walk away from what God expects of them because they think that that's more important. We worship our jobs like the sacred cow we have made them to be. Well, verse 24 will tell us what will happen one day. Scarcely shall they be planted, scarcely shall they be sown, scarcely shall their stock take root in the earth, when he also will blow on them and they will wither, and the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. Who do you know that's on their deathbed and said, man, I wish I could go to work? Who on their deathbed is wishing that they had a pay raise? I'm not the prophet, nor am I the son of the prophet, but I can pretty much tell you that everybody on their deathbed is not thinking about their job. But that was an idol in their life. And so, how do we relate? Well, God is so great. It is the truth. God is so great, it is impossible to fathom the depths of who and what he is. Scientists claim that there are at least 100 billion galaxies, and they don't really know the number, 100 billion galaxies, and each galaxy is made up of about 100 billion stars. Did you see verse 26? Lift up your eyes on high, see who has created these things, who brings out their hosts by number. He calls them all by name. I have 13 grandchildren. Sometimes I have to think, now who are you? Don't ask me when they were born. I have no idea. Some I do. But I mean, you know, and as I said this morning, okay, it's not fair. You get to remember one name. I got to remember a bunch more. Tonight, if you live where you can see the stars, you go out and look at those stars, and then you think, okay, Bob, Fred, George, Sally, and you start naming the stars, and you tell me how far you get. God, and this is not an exaggeration, God has a name for every star that we can see. I didn't know there was an alphabet that big. So how do I compare to that kind of power? And how can I refuse to serve a God so powerful? How can I do that when I see how great he is? But he concludes by saying in verse 27, he brings them out their host by number and brings them out by name. Verse 27 in the lesson jurors, down to the end. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God? Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run, not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Having shown his great power, Isaiah now presents the Lord as the one who is eternal. Who is the one who is eternal? He does not faint. He does not grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. And there is no searching of his understanding because his understanding is inscrutable. There's no comparison. No one can measure the depths of his understanding. Now, I mean, we've been in awe of what we've seen already. To him, nations are a drop in the bucket. To him, he speaks and it is done. To him, he has a name for all the stars. To him, all omniscience is known and given. God is not powerless. He is omnipotent. He is omniscient. He is omnipresent. God is the source of all strength. And when we do not immerse ourselves in the Word of God to know and embrace the character about how great God's glory is, we have not understood how great the glory of God is. But take note of what happens when we trust in Him. That's what moved Abraham to do what he did, because he believed this. That's what moved Moses and David and Daniel and Sarah and Ruth and everybody. When you and I wait on the Lord, there is nothing we cannot accomplish by the grace of God. Because in verse 26, we are victorious. We are victorious because He's got that kind of power, and that's how incredibly great He is. How could I not serve Him? How can I not devote my life to Him? He is the greatest thing that we have ever known. Because the revealed Word leads us to trust in Him for everything. Nothing is lacking in my life because God's glory. Our spirits are higher, our families are more secure, our marriages abundant, our hope realized, our life has meaning because we know the God of glory. We know this God. We serve this God. And what God did is that He loved us so much that He gave us His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth Him should not perish but have everlasting life. And through that, Jesus has become the door. Jesus has become the one in which we will be saved. He is the one in which we can go in and come out and find pasture. He is the one that we can have life and that we may have it more abundantly because He is the good shepherd, because the good shepherd gave His life for my sins. He died on the cross. That's the glory of God. You didn't have to die. I didn't have to die. Jesus, who was perfect, gave His life to die for us, to let us know how great and powerful God is. Because the cross was not a moment of defeat, it was the moment of victory when God said, "Let me show you my glory," and He did. And that's who I serve. That's who I praise. And that's who I honor. Because He is so incredibly great. If you're not a Christian, you will find nothing greater and you will find no one greater. You cannot save yourself. You cannot save yourself by being a good person. You cannot save yourself by being a religious person. You can only be saved by the glory of God about who He is and what He is. You got to believe that He is and that He is a rewarder of them who diligently seek Him. And then you have to come to Jesus Christ, who said, "He that believeth and is baptized should be saved, and he that believeth not should be condemned." There's no other way to read that. And if you're not a Christian, why not come to this God who loves you so much and gave His Son to be the propitiation for your sins? Why not do that tonight? Let's stand and let's sing.